Hi, and welcome to another edition of Critical Q&A, the show where I answer your questions based on what you leave me in the comments section here of this video and send to me at the email address that I've left in the notes section here. You know, I'm really excited this week because not only am I answering more of your questions, but I've also got two new shows written that I'll be producing in the next week or two, and they're about critical thinking, and not really about Scientology. And I'm excited about that because, you know, I want to talk about when I first started this channel, when I was recovering from Scientology, actually, I came across critical thinking, and it was a real godsend to me because with that I was introduced to the concepts of skepticism and rationality and logic, and it kind of opened up whole new doors for me, and I've been learning a lot about those things ever since and using them not just to analyze Scientology but also everything that comes across my plate. And when you look at current events, politics, religion, culture, artificial intelligence, computers, you know, with critical thinking, you get a much different perspective than what you get from the media or from the talking heads or from, you know, scare tactics that get run on the public by, you know, whoever, various agendas or whatever. And it gives you a different perspective. It gives you a much saner perspective on things because you understand things much, much easier and much better. And that's what I made this channel for. Those are the things I want to move into talking about and sharing with you and learning more about with, as I learn more, I want you guys to learn more. And so I'm really, really excited about moving in this, onto these new shows. So we'll be starting small, you know, what critical thinking, what is it, things like that. And I'm not going to try to reinvent the wheel, and there are other resources out there that talk about critical thinking and teach about critical thinking, and I'm not going to try to repeat what they're talking about. I just want to bring my own perspective to it, and my own perspective using critical thinking to things, and see where it goes. So anyway, let's get on with the questions this week, and we'll take it from there. Layla Rafat, can you tell us when did Scientology start being a church? Was it after the IRS investigations? All right, this is all according to my best recollection, so if I don't get everything right, don't shoot me on this. But Hubbard first used the word Scientology publicly in a lecture in late 1951 when he was talking to Dianeticists, I believe, in Wichita, Kansas. The next year in 19... That was the first time that word ever popped up, and it just popped up once. And then early 1952, he was giving another lecture series where he brought it up very specifically right from the get-go. And there was a lecture, and it was called Scientology or something to do with Scientology. And he introduced this word and said, this is the direction we're going in now. And he defined it as knowing how to know, you know, skio, logos, Scientology, knowing how to know. But the church had not formed up yet. I'm just talking about the first times that the word pops up. So then, this is early 1952, so now fast forward to late 1953. Dianetics has tanked and, you know, gone bankrupt, and that whole thing has happened. So Hubbard incorporates the first Church of Scientology in Camden, New Jersey in 1953, late 1953. But he doesn't open up any church in Camden, he just incorporates it as an organization. I don't know exactly what the politics or rigmarole or whatever was going on then, but then in 1954 is when the actual first Church of Scientology opened its doors, and that was in Los Angeles. And that's the Los Angeles Church of Scientology, which is still there. It's the oldest church organization that there is. And then what happened is, I believe it was 1956, when they finally got IRS recognition and tax exemption. I could be wrong on that, but I believe it was 1956 when the IRS accepted that the Church of Scientology was a religion and for tax-exempt purposes. So that's when Scientology's tax-exempt history starts. And what happened was, in 1967, Okay, fast forward from 1956 to 1967. The IRS had been investigating Scientology, and they declared in 1967 that the Churches of Scientology, which were now this worldwide organization, all operated for the inurement of L. Ron Hubbard, meaning that the entire corporate structure existed in order to give him personal profit. He was personally profiting from Scientology. That's what the IRS investigation determined, and they canceled, they revoked the tax-exempt status, and Scientology lost it internationally. And I think at that time, all of Scientology was sort of internationally incorporated in the Church of Scientology of California, CSC. And so they just revoked CSC's tax-exempt status. And so all of Scientology suddenly was not tax-exempt anymore. And despite the church fighting and fighting and fighting for years and years and years, all through the rest of the 60s, 70s, 80s, this was actually one of the best-kept secrets. I mean, nobody really talked about this. They didn't, you know, nobody could claim Scientology exemptions, you know, from taxes for religious donations. But they didn't talk about the battle or why the church had lost tax-exempt status. Nobody knew in the Scientology world that it was because the IRS determined that Hubbard was personally profiting from the whole activity. So this battle waged on back and forth, and the whole time that Hubbard was alive up until he died in 86, they were accumulating more and more tax debt. More, millions and millions and millions of dollars, because the church refused to pay any taxes to the IRS while this was going on, because they were so sure they were right and they weren't going to fight, and also they, you know, didn't really have the money. So come 1993, the big, you know, monumental war is over thing, and the IRS granting Scientology tax-exempt status again, that's why it was such a big deal, because, you know, now Hubbard was no longer around, so the inurement issue was gone. You know, he wasn't personally profiting from it anymore. And as I've mentioned in other videos, and as well documented all around on the internet, Scientology had reincorporated into this massive labyrinth scheme of corporations and shell corporations, and it's just a nightmare. It's a disaster. You know, it's just you trying to worm your way through it is. It's a total shell game, and all of it exists to hide where the money is going and how it's being spent and who's getting what and who has control of what, and it's just this labyrinth maze of corporations now, so as to prevent them from ever having that happen to them again. So anyway, that's kind of the short version of you know, kind of a long answer to a short question, but that's the history of it as I understand it. So Uncle Polyclot. Hi Chris, I really enjoy these critical Q&A videos. Here is my question. When you informed the Church of Scientology about your decision to leave the Sea Organization, were you required to pay the freeloader's debt? Is it something that's legally enforceable? What will happen to those who decide to leave and yet refuse to pay up, aside from being declared suppressive persons? Thanks. There seems to be a lot of misunderstandings or confusions about freeloader's debts. So I'll answer this question and see if I can't clear up some of this. A person does not get declared suppressive if they don't pay their freeloader's debt. That's not how it works. A freeloader's debt, Hubbard declared a person a freeloader. He wrote policies that said, if you break your contract with the church as an employee of the church or volunteer of the church, as a staff member in a local organization or as a Sea Org member, you are called a freeloader, and you can no longer you can't do any Scientology services until you pay for the services that you received for free when you were a staff member. That's what the freeloader debt is. And they calculate it all out when you leave, and they'll tell you what it is. And it's based on the staff training, auditing, courses that you do in Scientology as a staff member, because when you're a staff member, volunteer for the church, you get those services for free. That's about the only thing they're giving you. They're taking away a lot more, but they're giving you that. So if you leave, they give you this debt, And the condition of the debt, it has nothing to do with the legal system. It's not a credit collected debt that they're going to like take you to court over. Nobody ever gets sued for this. That's not how it works. It's a pressure that the church exerts on its own members for as long as they're members to pay for the services they received when they were staff if they want to continue to do Scientology. That's how it works. If you leave the church, if you leave staff, and you don't really want to do Scientology anymore, you just walk away. They're not going to come after you for the freeloader's debt. They're not going to, you know, they're going to call you if they think you're still a Scientologist. But if you just kind of fade away and disappear, that's it. It's over. It's done. They're not going to, assign bill collectors to you and hunt you down and all that kind of stuff. They do try to hunt you down to get you back in Scientology, but the freeloader's debt thing is not the impetus for that. It's trying to get you back in the church. That's the impetus for that. If that makes sense. It's not the money of the freeloader's debt, and there's no threat of legal action. So anyway, I just wanted to kind of emphasize a few points in that answer to make it clear. Me personally, yes, I did pay my freeloader's debt, because when I left the C organization and I got my freeloader's debt, I still wanted to do Scientology. And I went through a lot of rigmarole, which I've described elsewhere, so I'm not going to go into it all here. But in going through all that rigmarole and nonsense and the stuff they were doing to me, I was trying to make good with the church. And I was trying to show that I was still a good Scientologist in good standing. And so I was trying to cooperate. And so I got the money and I paid the freeloader's debt on my own free will. And it was actually just after that I ended up, you know, taking a hike. And I was posting on the internet. And it was because I was posting on the internet anonymously, and they found out who I was, and they busted me on that. That's what led to me being declared, because I was being openly critical and attacking the church. And that's why I got declared. And that's not, you know, obviously I was discovering things about the church. I had issues with the church, and I was trying to resolve those issues. And the church did what it does, which is, you know, come down hard on me and basically did everything they could to make me an enemy of them. And that's why I took a hike, and that's why they declared me a suppressive person. And now I'm a suppressive person to them. So that's the story on that. So anyway, I hope that clears that up a little bit and answers your question. Mr. Spock. Wow, Chris, I really admire you for this useful and nice way to give answers on this bloody matter. Here's my question. Can you share with us your reaction once discovered, through the books on him, the real life of LRH? Personally, that was the key factor that changed my viewpoint on the whole matter. Yeah, I'll talk about this. When I had left the C organization, within a couple months, I was, being persecuted in various ways by the church, and so that kind of drove me to seek out answers as to what was going on, why was the church doing this, and I knew that there were answers on the internet. I just hadn't really gone into looking at them in depth when I was still in the church and still in the C organization. I glossed over some of that, but I hadn't gotten into it too much. You know, I thought, for example, that Tony Ortega was the biggest jerk on the planet because he was always bad-mouthing Scientology, but I came to learn that he's actually a really great guy. So and he and I get along great now, but at the time I thought he was a total jerk. So anyway, I knew that there was information out there, in other words, but I wasn't reading it. And when things started going sour with the church and me, I went and started looking into that stuff. And I went, as they call it, down the rabbit hole. And that took me months. It was a weeks and weeks long process of discovery, finding out all this information about, you know, things that had been going on in the C organization and in Scientology for decades, finding out all about Operation Snow White, finding out all about and seeing Hubbard's directives and issues and policies that were confidential inside the church, but they're all over the internet. So I was seeing these things, many of them, for the first time, and you know, and I could definitely recognize Hubbard's writing. And so it was shocking to me that he was telling and advising and directing that people's lives be ruined if they were critics of the church. I had no idea. I had no idea that Operation Snow White had occurred and it had been as extensive as it was. I had no idea about Hubbard himself. I started diving into that. That was one of the last things I wanted to accept, because Hubbard, and when you're a Scientologist, L. Ron Hubbard is a guru. He's God. He's source. He is the man. He's infallible. He's a guy who never gets it wrong. And so to find out that his school records were a lie, his university records were a lie, his war record was a lie, that he had numerous wives, kids, I mean, all of this was brand new information to me, and it was shocking information. It turned my whole world upside down, and I really did feel like I was falling down a rabbit hole, just like Alice in Wonderland at that point. That was how I felt in my head. And I realized the point of the biggest betrayal for me was when I got all that information, looked at the OT levels, read those, you know, knew that at that point I'd gone past the point of no return. There was no going back after that. Found out what crap they were, like how illogical, they didn't make any sense, they didn't fit in with the rest of Scientology as far as I was concerned, and they were just ridiculous. I'd never seen any of that when I was in Scientology because I hadn't made it to the OT levels. So all of that combined started forming this picture in my head that I had been part of a con on all of these public that I'd been servicing and thinking I was helping for all these years. And I started really seeing, a dominant, you know, everything started lining up, that this was a money-making operation only. Like, that's all it was doing. And everything else was window dressing. And that was, you know, when you give a better part of your life to an organization and to a movement that you feel and are told over and over and over again, very heavily indoctrinated into the idea that you are saving the world. And then you find out that that's not what you've been doing at all. That is the word shock, betrayal, awe. I mean, these words don't really, you know, describe how I felt about it. I've never felt such a sense of betrayal before. I never felt so taken advantage of. And I never felt like my life was such a fake, you know. And it was not fun. It was not pleasant to get that, to go through that experience. So, you know, so after that was done, and that's what drove me to start posting on the internet, because the depth of my anger was so great. I had such an anger reaction to it and a betrayal. I had to vent. I had to get something out. I had to talk to somebody, and there wasn't really anybody in my vicinity at that time that I could talk to in person about this. I couldn't. So that's why I started, you know, venting online, and not under my own name. I used an assumed name. I went on to the ex-Scientology message board, and I came up with the name I Hate Duplicity. That was my name. I Hate Duplicity, and I started posting and venting, and, you know, Hubbard and Miscavige and Steer, rah rah rah. And anyway, one thing led to another, and, you know, a few months later, about 8 months later, I was declared and out. And a couple months after that is when I started doing videos, did my first interview, and the rest is history. So that's I think that's the answer to your question. Knows me by my name. Chris, you mentioned that people in Scientology sometimes have euphoric experiences. So the question I have is it realistic to expect people to walk away from a source of euphoric pleasure? How often does this happen? Is it realistic for people to think they can pursue that activity / activities outside the church? What church activity produces that effect? Is effect the correct word there, or do I want effect? Hee hee. The euphoric feeling that I was talking about is mainly brought about through auditing, the counseling that the Church of Scientology offers, because they do that counseling in order to specifically to produce that result. There are certain training actions a person can do, like those TRs, those communication drills, where a kind of euphoria can also set in, but that's not really, generally speaking, comparable to what happens in the counseling. That's where the heavy indoctrination occurs. That's where all the mental, mind stuff happens through the processes of Scientology, the methods that are applied by the counselors, the auditors, to the public. And anyway, so that's where the euphoric feeling comes from. Is it realistic to expect people to walk away from that? Of course it is. I mean, I did. Other, thousands of other people have. It's not a problem, really, because it's a temporary thing. I mean, it comes and it goes, and then it's gone. And you start realizing after years of this, or months of this, or whatever, depending on how bright you are and how much common sense you have, and how heavily, you've been drinking the Kool-Aid, so to speak, it starts dawning on you that, this isn't really working. My life's not getting any better. It's not changing for the better and improving, and I'm not more spiritually powerful than I was the day I walked in. And that is, in fact, a complaint that Scientologists have, and they, internally, and they'll, say something about it, and then that gets addressed with more auditing. If at first it didn't work, I'd bang on the guy's head some more. So that's kind of how it goes. People sometimes who are in the church, who believe in Scientology, but they see that the organization's corrupt or Miscavige is bad, but they still believe in Hubbard and they still believe in the tech of Scientology, the technology, will leave the church and they'll go do independent Scientology, right? Which you might have heard of is, people practicing Scientology out in the world, where they do counseling at their houses and stuff like that, and it's not officially church-sanctioned activity. In fact, the church really hates that kind of thing. They'll do that, and they do that because they are still trying to get that euphoria and get that good feeling and, continuous Scientology procedures, even though they don't want to be part of the Church of Scientology. So that kind of thing goes on, and it's going on right now. It's happened, there's places you can go, people you can contact to do that. But it's been my experience, for the most part, that as time goes on and people recover from Scientology and start learning more and more about it, now that they can look at the internet and read books and see what's going on with it, and they get some time and some distance away from all the heavy, cult indoctrination that occurs when you're in the church, they start separating and seeing that it's kind of really just a bunch of crap, and eventually just move away from it and aren't interested in getting any more of that auditing, and they don't want to be calling themselves Scientologists anymore, and they just take off entirely. So that tends to be what I've seen occur, although that's not, not every single person ever, but the majority of people I've seen, that's what I've seen happen. So, and some people come out of Scientology, just to be clear about this, like I did, and they don't want to have anything more to do with it. It's not like you have to go through this stage of being an independent Scientologist. It's just that some people that happens to. So there you go. Brain soap. Hey Chris, you've mentioned several times some opinions on David Miscavige. Do you think he believes in Scientology, or is he just a con man running a racket? LRH was quoted by James Randi as saying religion was a good way to get rich quick. Do you feel he came to start believing his own lies as Scientology grew? Love the vids and love the rational perspective on Church of Scientology criticism. Okay, this is a controversial subject, or topic, or question, and it's not one I can give a definitive answer to, because LRH Hubbard's mindset, did he or did he not believe in the con, or did he kind of believe in the con, and what were his purposes and intentions? It's a wholly subjective question. I can't answer it for sure. I can only give my opinion. Based on everything I know now, my opinion is that Hubbard was a deeply troubled person, mentally, spiritually. I think he was a narcissist, and I think he had some megalomania going on, if I want to put some labels there. I think he was a pretty complex guy, just like everybody. You know, I don't think it was a simple matter of, you know, black and white, well, he was this or he was this, you know. But I think he entered into Scientology or Dianetics actually first and then Scientology with the idea of making money. And I think he didn't have a problem conning people out of their money. I don't think he had a problem cheating people, knowingly doing so. But I think at the same time, he was developing or trying to develop this technology of the mind and then the spirit because he was trying to solve things going on in his own head. And there's evidence, there's pretty compelling evidence to suggest that that's what was going on with him. You know, from the Going Clear documentary, from his own words, you know, from people who were around at the time who knew him and their testimonials about the man. So that's kind of, that's how I think it started. My opinion is that as the years progressed and as Hubbard got deeper and deeper into this and more adoration and admiration and worship practically by the people who were following him as Scientologists as it grew to an international movement, by the time the 1960s rolled around, I think he went off the deep end completely. And I think he totally bought into his own crap. And I think he fully believed in it. Now, there's people who argue a totally opposite position. And like I said, it's totally subjective. Me, you, nobody can know what was going on in that guy's head. But I think, based on what he was doing, how he was doing it, how he was running the organizations, how he personally was auditing himself every single day, putting himself on that meter and trying to figure out what was going on in his head, I think he believed in what he was doing. And he did that until he died in 1986. Kept throwing himself on that E-meter and trying to audit out his BTs, you know, his body thetans, and trying to, like, clear himself and all this. And he had heart attacks, he was on drugs. I mean, this guy was messed up. But he kept trying to use his own technology on himself to make himself better or free himself or whatever it was he was trying to do. And he was under this, you know, God delusion that he had found this great, you know, he thought he was this great spiritual philosopher, and he was very full of himself. And he carried this thing forward, and he did, you know, he wrote tons and tons. He gave thousands of lectures. Who does that? You know, I think there's a pretty good argument to be made that he believed his own con. And maybe he didn't to start with. Maybe he thought it was a con to start with, and he knew what he was doing, and the whole quote about him, you know, getting into it just to make money. Like I said, I think he had some personal issues he was trying to deal with as well. But I think by the time the 1960s rolled around, he was way deep into it. So that's my opinion on it. And as far as Miscavige goes, I don't think Miscavige is a true believer because he doesn't do any of the tech on himself. He refuses, in fact. Doesn't want anything to do with it. And I think he's, you know, I think he's just a power-hungry guy who is running that organization for personal power purposes. I think that's what he's all about. So, Minket, any thoughts on career choices as you move forward? Perhaps additional education or coursework? Yeah, absolutely. I learn stuff all the time. I'm constantly reading, learning, watching, trying to improve my education on critical thinking, on science, on skepticism. I look at religion. I look at all kinds of stuff, right? I have a lot of friends who are atheists and agnostics and skeptics and humanists, and I, you know, talk to them all the time, and I'm very, very interested in pursuing those activities, learning more about them. I love learning stuff, and I think it's essential to be a good critical thinker that you are hungry for knowledge and constantly trying to learn more. It's requisite to being a critical thinker. Critical thinking is not a static activity. It's not, you know, I now know everything there is to know about this, and, you know, that's the very opposite of critical thinking. So I try to, you know, I'm very much involved in that. As far as career choices, I mean, I'm a graphic designer and video editor and videographer. That's what I do for a living right now. I love doing it, you know, and I actually got into doing it from my YouTube channel. So I went from that to doing it for a living, and I love doing it. But, you know, I don't know if I could end up, you know, in education or teaching or something like that. That'd be awesome. I'd love to do that. I'm not going to go do 4 or 6 years of college. You know, that's not going to happen. So I don't know exactly what my future holds for me on that, but I do know that I'll be continuing this channel, and I will be continuing my learning, and I'll be doing courses online or otherwise, and definitely improving myself and trying through that to improve the rest of the world, because that purpose with me has never died. I had that all through Scientology, and I still have it. So there you go. Mary Hadfad. Chris, I always see a keyboard at the edge of the screen. Can you play? If so, do you have any plans to dismantle the corrupt power structures of Scientology via the power of musical theater? I think that could be very effective. Possible song ideas. I Get a Kick Out of Xenu. Audit Takes Two. Under the Sea, Org. Do I Love You Because You're a Level 8 Operating Thetan? It took me 18 minutes to come up with those. Thank me at the Tony Awards. I love those. I have this keyboard here, and I really don't know how to play it very well. I've got this book on it that is about on page 5, learning how to, you know, do sort of thing. And I keep it there to remind myself that that's something I want to, you know, learn how to do. So I will be learning that, but I don't think I'm going to be, you know, conquering Scientology through musical theater. I don't see any rock operas in my future taking down, you know, the big church. So, no. And so we come to the end of another critical Q&A show. Thank you very much for watching. And look forward to those new shows coming out on critical thinking in the near future. As I and keep the questions pouring in. I love it. I love hearing from you guys. I wish I had more time to answer more comments. I try to get to those, and I will continue. But anyway, thank you very much for watching, and I'll talk to you again soon.